We're at the Granley Bacon Resort, just outside Tahoe City in California. This is one of the Keystone Symposia. It's a meeting on new insights into health span and diseases of aging, from molecular to functional senescence. And we have kind of a women in science and technology group here. So why don't you introduce yourself? Shilpi, do you want to start?
Sure. My name's Shilpi Kare, and I'm a graduate student in Stephen Clark's lab at UCLA.
Celine?
My name is Céline Riera, and I am a postdoc at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies in Andy Dillon's lab.
Right. We've already met Melanie, but perhaps you could introduce yourself again.
Sure. I'm Melanie Samuel. I'm a postdoc with Josh Sains at Harvard University.
And Gianna?
Yes. My name is Gianna Angelo, and I'm a postdoctoral fellow at Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, Washington, in the Van Gils lab.
Right. So let's get some sense of, first of all, what your interests are. You actually did a short presentation.
Yes.
Why don't you just give us a quick sense of what was that was about?
Well, in the Van Gils lab, one of the things we study is the metabolic adaptation to fasting. And so using C. elegans, which is a microscopic worm we use as our model organism, and we try to understand how animals adapt to their changing nutrient environment, namely caloric restriction and fasting. We discovered a new life history trait in worms called adult reproductive diapause. So this is a new state that hadn't been characterized, and we can learn a lot about how adult cells respond to starvation.
Okay, now I just talked to George Martin, and I stopped him and said, what do you mean by diapause? And he said, well, kind of a developmental timeout. So is that roughly?
That's a perfect way of defining it. Yeah, it's a regulated state of ceasing development. Yeah, you're sort of, you halt because things aren't very good. But it's still a dynamic process. So even though the term is, by definition, a state of halted development, a lot is still happening to keep the worm happy during the diapause.
Okay. So normally that would be because of lack of resources, right?
Precisely.
Okay. So go on with your story then.
So we discovered this new diapause that worms enter, when adult worms enter, and they can stay like that for a really long time in the starved state. And it's, as I mentioned, dynamic. So we discovered that there are germline stem cells that endure starvation, and they can completely recover when conditions improve, so that an adult worm that had been starved for so far as long as 80 days can go on to recover and produce offspring and live out a normal lifespan in spite of being starved for a really long time.
So this is an unusual result, right?
This is, yes.
Quite a significant result. So, how do these? This is a meeting brings together a group of people from all sorts of disciplines. So there's also the practical applications as well, and we all wonder what the human applications are. I mean, we're talking about an organization here. A creature here, which is about the size of a speck of dust.
Yeah.
So how do we take that kind of information and make it applicable to people sitting in chairs?
Worms are a lot more like people than most people realize, when we think. I know, you wouldn't think it, but their DNA, their genetic material, is, and the genes that are very important for adapting to these sorts of changes in their environment are the same in worms and humans. So by understanding these, and you can do a lot more with a worm than a person at this point. It's easier to starve a worm right now than it is a person. And so by doing that, I can understand a lot of this process in a worm, and the things that are happening in the cell of a worm will likely be conserved and are conserved. A lot of these pathways are conserved in the cells of humans. And so it gives us a lot of insight to what those mechanisms are that are operating.
Okay, but one last thing before we go around the table. If you're talking about caloric restriction or dietary restriction, this is something that people are now starting to do. They think it increases their lives, increases longevity and so on. I spoke at a little conversation yesterday with Paul Shaw and Mark Tater and Sean Oldham, and said, okay, so calorie restriction, that's a given, right? That's something that humans do and really works. And they looked at me and said, well, in rodents, yeah, and in worms, yeah, but there's no solid evidence in humans yet, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's... a lot of the work I think that's done with the animal models, I think people are interested in trying to understand the mechanism so that you can maybe develop they call them mimetics, fasting mimetics, and so that you can activate these pathways that are happening in these animals using, you know, pharmacoreagents or things that you can give a person so that you can mimic that response in a specific tissue or something without, you know, having to actually starve the person or calorically restrict. But it's important to understand all the things that are happening so that you can produce that sort of product.
Okay. Now, do you want to do a quick reprise on your work? I saw the poster last night. Mm-hmm. We had a nice conversation about that. Mm-hmm. So...
Sure. The basic underlying information about the work that I do is that many people, as they age, experience cognitive decline, and it's a really significant impact on human health and our ability to live well into old age. So I study CNS aging, and specifically how different neuronal populations age relative to each other. And we do that using the retina, which is a part of the central nervous system that's very well understood. So it allows us to ask how aging affects different neuronal populations. And then once we understand that, we can elucidate the pathways underlie those changes and hopefully test ways to reverse age-induced changes to neurons.
Okay. So do you work with specialized hospitals as well? I mean, like eye hospitals and so on. Is this yet a translational stage where your information can be fed into...
Currently, we work with mouse models. There are certainly some human studies looking at aged brains, but as we were just discussing, it's difficult to do any sort of experimental science with human subjects. So we do all of our studies in animal models, and then as studies progress, we hope that we'll be able to develop treatments or therapies that will eventually be usable in the clinic.
Yeah, okay. So, Celine, you're in Andy Dillon's lab, mm-hmm. or my colleagues at Salk, but you came from Switzerland.
Exactly.
And you work on sensory systems
exactly.
and the modulation of aging, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do taste, touch, and
smell
modulate aging?
So far what we know is that in model organisms, just like C. elegans and Drosophila, flies and worms that have a decreased sensory perception, whether it's chemically mediated like gustatory or olfaction,
mm-hmm.
Have an increased longevity. And this is also true for mechanical perception of the environment. And the goal is to understand how this lack of perception can increase lifespan. We know it does, and we want to understand whether it does it in more evolved organisms like mice.
Yeah, yeah. It just sounds like an odd story, doesn't it? I mean, I looked at a couple of the papers, and you're doing experiments with spicy peppers and artificial sweeteners and so on.
Yeah.
So, did you know about this?
I know about the phenomenon, but I didn't realize what sorts of reagents you were using, actually.
So where do you think this is going to go? I mean, do you have any sense of...
So one of the questions is whether the upstream perception of the environment,
mm-hmm.
the direct sensing of the external stimuli, can activate some well-known pathways of aging, like the insulin signaling pathway.
Mm-hmm.
I think...
this is the insulin IGF-1.
Exactly. For example, smelling food, humans that are starved and that smell food, have an increase in insulin release. So we think that there is a direct connection between these genetic pathways, and we want to understand it, how the sensory neurons that respond to the environmental stimuli can directly connect with the metabolic...
So I think the food industry is going to be all over this stuff when it comes out, isn't it? So... let's go to Shilpi. You're at UCLA.
Correct.
And what stage of development are you at this point?
So I'm in the middle of my fifth year in graduate school.
Okay.
And yeah, as I mentioned, I work in Steve Clark's lab.
And in our lab, we...
Which is chemistry. You're a chemist.
Correct. I'm in biochemistry, and we're primarily focused on identifying methyltransferases in a variety of model systems. So we identify methyltransferases and characterize their activity. So these are protein methyltransferases.
Okay, so tell me what methyltransferases are.
So a methyltransferase,
why I should care.
Just as the name indicates, it transfers a methyl group to an amino acid. Right. So the methyltransferase I study is called protein carboxyl methyltransferase, and it transfers a methyl group to isomerized aspartic acid residues. And these aspartic acid residues basically isomerize with age spontaneously, so they increase with age. So that's why we're very interested in characterizing this methyltransferase, because it's important in reversing this isomerization damage that occurs. And so I'm studying PCM1 and C. elegans. And we find that in control conditions, this enzyme, in the absence of this enzyme, mutants mimic wild-type animals. But this enzyme becomes very important under stressful conditions. And in my project, in my poster I presented at the Keystone, we examined what both wild-type and mutant C. elegans lacking this enzyme, what happens to them under oxidative stress conditions. And so we find that worms which lack this PCM1 repair enzyme undergo more severe developmental delays and develop defects in egg laying. So in the absence of this enzyme, these worms really do not know how to deal well with oxidative stress. Mm-hmm. And so we're really trying to understand the interplay between protein isomerization and oxidative stress, and in the context of aging.
Okay, great. So what's your take on the meetings? Has this been a sort of uplifting experience for you? I mean, what's your take on it? Anybody?
This is my first aging meeting. Right. So for me, it's been really, it has been, it's, I think it's been a great meeting. It's the first time I've been to something that I can attend all of the talks, and they're the leaders in the field who I read their papers, but, you know, have never met them individually. And it's been really good to see the way that my work fits into the aging community. And I've had a lot of really good support and great feedback. That's my impression so far. Mm.
Have you managed to sort of actually go and talk to some of the people like Cynthia Kenyon, for example, in your particular area?
Yeah, I met Cynthia Kenyon for the first time. And, you know, she's a bundle of energy. And I was so nice to finally meet her, you know, because a lot of my work is, you know, dovetails and overlaps with what she does. And so we've spoken briefly. I'm hoping I get to spend more time talking to her. But, yeah, everyone is really accessible. And I haven't spoken to her as much as I've spoken to a few other people when you sit down for dinner, and I've gotten some good insights from, you know, people who do stem cell research in other tissues and other model organisms in particular, and been able to establish some potentially new collaborations. So it's been really nice.
So did you come here with somebody in mind that you wanted to go and talk to specifically, so get some information from? Whether, you know, is there somebody in your field that you wanted to talk to?
What's interesting is that in my field of protein repair and aging, I think when I'm talking to people such as Claudio Torres, who's involved in looking at proteasome activation with the insulin signaling pathway, that's definitely something I'm very interested in, or, you know, how the cells deal with this problem of having an increase in protein load, proteins that are damaged. So I think from that point of view, I'm really interested in neurodegeneration and what the effects are of reduced autophagy and clearance, or defects in clearance of damaged proteins. So I think in that perspective, I've been trying to kind of make connections and talk to people involved in those areas.
Yeah. So I'm curious to know how you ended up going into science. I mean, we've had a conversation, and I know that you went into science, but you also ended up doing some science writing and so on. Remind me, just for the, since it'll be a different kind of audience, what got you into science in the first place?
So none of my family is in science. In fact, most of them are farmers or do sort of very different jobs. And when I was in high school, I took a class in biology, and it was the first time I really understood sort of how DNA works and what it does, and we ran a gel in class, and it was a breathtaking experience for a young 17-year-old girl. So it really shifted my attention to biology and sort of in some ways what seems like the magic of science, like the incredible